Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, we have a listener favorite joining us again today, Brad Taylor, with his latest thriller in the Pike Logan series, End of Days. Pike Logan's journey this time finds him chasing a serial killer and following evidence that leads to the Exalted Knights of Malta. That drives Pike and his task force deep into the dangers of religious fanaticism and political fractures. Let me tell you a little about Brad. He is a retired lieutenant colonel. He's a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Army Infantry and Special Forces. He served 8 years with the 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment, commonly known as Delta Force. And in 2010, Brad retired. His first novel was published the following year, and that launched the Pike Logan thriller series, a series that's now 16 books in and has taken readers all around the globe. So here's my guest, Brad Taylor, with End of Days. Brad Taylor, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I think we've talked 3 or 4 times before. I've kind of lost count and I meant to check before we logged on here. And I think most of our listeners know, most of your readers know, that you draw on your real life experience as a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Army and Special Forces for the excitement that goes into your book. But I heard recently that when you were younger, you wanted to be an archaeologist. So what happened?
My father's son, and when I said I'm going to study archaeology in college, he was like, waste of time, and I'm not paying for that.
Okay. Well, that's a good enough reason, right? I guess. But I was wondering when I heard that if you knew Brad Ricker, who's also an author, and he writes a lot of historical stories, mostly nonfiction, but he was also a fan of the Harrison Ford Raiders and just wrote a book called True Raiders about a real life search for the Ark, but you had some similarities there as kids.
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah. So we're talking about End of Days, which is your 16th book in the Pike Logan Jennifer Cahill series. Did you think you'd get this far?
Absolutely not. Nobody's more surprised than me. I never thought I'd have one book published, much less 16.
Well, it's a great read, you know, and I say this as somebody who's never been interested. If any book had a military symbol on the front or anything like that, I was just never interested in it. But you're such a good storyteller and you make people feel as though they're actually there. So I've become a huge fan. Let's share with our listeners just a little of the story without giving away the whole plot, but certainly things that are on the book jacket we can talk about. And, of course, it starts with Pike Logan, Jennifer Cahill. They're quarantined in Charleston during COVID, and they get a knock on the door from 2 Mossad operators. I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, actually, one of the hardest part about writing this book, I was locked in COVID like everybody else, and I had to make a decision. Do I include COVID in the book? I mean, do I ignore it and just say that, you know, it doesn't exist, or do I put it in? And there's 2 schools of thought on that. I mean, I have a lot of author friends, and they're like, I'm never writing about COVID. Screw that. And I was like, well, I write about current events, and this is current. I mean, yeah. It's happening. And so I decided to put it in the book. It's obviously not a book about COVID. It's COVID now becomes something that the task force, my Pike Logan's organization, has to deal with. They have to deal with the weather. They have to deal with flight times. They have to deal with the target. They have to deal with the enemy. Now they have to deal with COVID. And as I did the research, the United States wasn't allowed to fly into the EU. We couldn't go anywhere because of our COVID, the spikes we had here. But Israel could. Israel had a huge vaccination program, and they were allowed to go anywhere in the EU. And luckily for me, I happen to have a couple of Israeli Mossad assassins on the bookshelf.
How handy.
Every 3 books or so. And so I decided to use them.
And so, if I remember right, when we talked about your last book, you deliberately chose not to include COVID in that one. I think you fudged the timeline, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I had been to the Shenlin Night Market in Taipei doing book research. I'd been all over Sydney Harbor. And then when we got home, COVID hit. And when I was writing the book, I was like, well, now what am I going to do? The Schindler Night Market had 1,000 people in there. It was jam-packed, which would now be called a super spreader.
Right, right.
We're all gone. Everybody's locked in. In Sydney Harbor, Pike does a surveillance effort in the Sydney Harbor right next to the Opera House. Well, now there's only going to be 2 people on the street, him and the Target.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, I'm going to fudge this one. I'm putting it at January 2020 when the Taiwanese elections were happening, which actually is what the book was about, so it wasn't that big of a fudge. But in this book, we were still in it, and I was like, you can't ignore it anymore. What are you going to do?
Right. Well, yeah, who thought we'd still be here, right? Let's talk about what makes your books different, and one of those is that obviously you tie into current events. Obviously, you are great at creating characters. So one of the things that is difficult always in a series to carry forward is to keep your characters growing. And Pike Logan married Jennifer Cahill eventually. And I read that your daughter actually came to you when she was small and said, hey, I have a great idea for when they get married. But it actually shows up in this book. So tell us about this.
Yeah, absolutely. So my first book got published, and my daughter was really young at that time. And she said, you know, are Pike and Jennifer going to get married? And I said, well, I hadn't really thought about it. I mean, I think at that time I was on book 3. I was like, you know, that's not something I'm really thinking about right now. And she said, well, when they do, I know how it's going to happen. She's going to go to the altar, and then these terrorists are going to burst into the church, and she's going to rip off her skirt and start throwing hand grenades everywhere. And I was like, okay, I'll take that under advisement. Every book, she was like, did you put the wedding scene in? And I was like, no. Well, now my daughter's in college. I mean, that's how long ago it was. And I said, hey, you finally made it in the book. You know, Pike's got a daydream of what he's daydreaming during the wedding rehearsal, and he does your scene. And, of course, now she's old enough to, she's like, I don't care.
That's funny. But one of the things that makes Pike Logan, I mean, you know, a lot of adventure characters or superhero characters, if you will, they've got to have some frailties and be human. And one of the things that is amusing is his Walter Mitty dream about that whole situation. So that really brings him down to earth and makes him very human, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially when, you know, Jennifer smacks him in the gut and says, what are you doing?
She's like, yeah. And he's like, nothing. So let's talk about the research that you did. And one of the things I want to ask you, first of all, because I know you have great experience with this, is where Mossad stands. And as I understand it, the National Security Intelligence Agency, much of the things we see about them, of course, in fiction, on film, I can never weigh up sometimes if they're the goodie or the baddie. And I guess it's like our CIA. It depends which side of the field you're standing on. But would you tell us a little bit of the background of the Mossad?
Yeah, well, specifically for Aaron and Shoshana, what I did was there are 2 units that operate. One operated in the Gaza Strip, one operates in the West Bank. Dudevant units that penetrate the area as Arabs. And they're real units. And the Samson team was the Gaza Strip team. Well, when they gave the Gaza Strip back to Palestine in 94, they disbanded that unit. And I took that as literary license and said, well, no, they actually didn't disband it. They used it for worldwide operations, like the Wrath of God teams after the 72 Munich Olympics. And I created, you know, I said, okay, they're still fighting, and they're going to use them. And Mossad does have those teams, and just like we do, but you know, you start when you're starting to write fiction, then you're really touching on, you know, I don't want to write anything that's so stupid that it doesn't happen. But on the other hand, I don't want to write anything that's like, I don't want to give anything away.
Right.
Kind of a balancing act.
Right, right. And so when you're doing your research, and of course it was different this time, I know you like to have boots on the ground and feel the earth and the terrain that you're researching. But you'd been to most of these places before, right? Switzerland and Paris and Croatia.
Yeah, that's the hardest part about this book was I couldn't get boots on the ground. I could not go overseas. And so luckily, only about 10% of my research actually makes it into a book. And luckily is still, iPhotos kept all my pictures. I started going back through it and saying, okay, what have you not used in a book, but you still know the terrain? You've been there. You know what it smells like. You know the food they cook. Where is that? And I had to go through, I mean, years of research. For instance, the grottos on the Lebanese border with Israel, that's a real place, and I've been there. It's a really neat place, and I really tried to cram that in a book one time, and I couldn't figure out how to make it work, so I didn't use it, luckily, because now I was like, all right, I can use it now.
Right.
That kind of thing happened over and over. So, for instance, the paragliding scene, the very beginning of the book, the assassination scene at Interlaken. I mean, I've been to Interlaken, but I didn't paraglide. My wife did. And so when I started writing that scene, I said, give me all your videos on that paraglide thing, you know, which is usually a video of the person smiling and laughing, and yeah, look at me. That's not what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the three-ring loop assembly that this guy's harness is attached to. I'm looking where his reserve chute is. I'm looking at how he took off. I'm looking at how he landed, so I could write that scene. And luckily, my wife had all those videos.
Right, and I'm guessing she expressed some of the emotions of getting up there, too, then. Well, you've probably been up there yourself at other times, right?
Well, I mean, I'm free-fall parachutist.
Exactly. So what do you decide when you've got so much research? You just said you only 10% of your research gets into the book. Always better to have too much information than not enough, right? So what do you decide to leave out? Obviously, you're going to leave out what's not relevant to the story, but where do you base your story? Is it based around the research, or does the story determine the research?
The story actually determines the research about 90% of the time. Sometimes it doesn't. I mean, I go to a lot of bad places, so I wrote a story for the Polaris Protocol, which involved Mexico City and the drug cartels and that kind of stuff. So that drove me going to Mexico City. Other times, my wife was like, I want to go on a research trip. I'm sick of staying at home. And I said, where do you want to go? She says, I want to go to Ireland. And I'm like, how am I going to make a story about Ireland? And so we went to Ireland, to Cambridge, to London, to Brussels and Paris. And I created that story out of whole cloth based on the fact that that's where she wanted to go, and so I had to figure it out. But there's enough stuff going on in the world that I can do either way. For this book itself, End of Days, it was specifically about, I knew the Temple Mount was going to be in there in the old city of Jerusalem, and so that kind of spiraled out from there.
Right. And I read in some of your press that don't be surprised if we start hearing about this in the news soon.
Yeah, hopefully not. I mean, it's always a flashpoint there, and there's always riots. And, just last week, Gaza was launching rockets into Israel, and Israel started launching rockets back. And there was a guy that went up on the Temple Mount and said, I'm going to start praying here. And Israel, their Supreme Court has ruled that there's a law in Israel that says that you cannot, as a Jew, preach or worship on the Temple Mount. Christians can't, Jews can't, because it's such a flashpoint. Well, the Supreme Court ruled that that's not a real good law. You can go up there and pray. And now I'm like, oh, here we go. It's going to start.
Yeah, it's a shame that religion is a focal point of many wars, and it should be a whole different perspective, I think. But let's look at what elements that are in the book that you took creative license with, because this is fiction. You're allowed to exaggerate or elaborate on certain facts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the books are as accurate as I can make them. If you read my books, you can do a Google search for a hotel, for a restaurant, for anything that's there. You'll find it. It's on the map. But having said that, there's certain times when I'm like, I need something. I have to have an alley, for instance. There's got to be an alley for Pike to Run Down, when the restaurant I'm talking about doesn't have an alley. Well, it does in my book. And obviously, I'll take creative license. If I'm doing an assault scene, and I'm inside a building that I've been in before, and I'm going to assault this building, and there's a breach point in the back of the room which somebody could escape from, and I don't want that breach point there. Well, it no longer exists. Now it's a wall.
Mm. Interesting. So no, don't look at Google Earth and expect it to be the same.
Well, you'll definitely see the place I'm talking about. I mean, for instance, these guys, there's the smuggling route in the days that they're going into Syria. There's a smuggling route that goes right over the top of those mountains, right next to the highest UN post in the world. And that UN post exists. It's there.
Uh-huh.
That smuggling route exists. It's there.
Fascinating. So what was the most challenging, beyond COVID, and, the challenges of not being able to get your boots on the ground there, what was the most challenging aspect of actually writing the story?
I would say that most, believe it or not, the most challenging thing was COVID. I don't write, I don't have a writing desk. I don't have a writing room. I have a MacBook Air and a MacBook Pro. And I'll load those things in my backpack and go off to a park or to a library or to a bar or the beach. And that's how I write. And then we got locked in, and a lot of people say, you know, oh, you're the perfect, you know, career to be locked in for COVID, because all you have to do is sit around by yourself and write. And that's not true. I mean, it was, you know, every single day on the couch. My wife's like, get off the couch. I'm like, where am I going to go? I got to write this thing. And I got lethargic, really. It was just kind of, I don't want to write. I don't want to do anything. Mm. It was hard to do.
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, I work outdoors a lot. I take my laptop to the beach, to the park, whatever. I can tune everything out. That's where I think best. That's where I brainstorm best. And I actually talked with a science journalist yesterday who, there is scientific evidence that being outdoors does spark that creativity. So it's interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, for me, it was just sitting here every day. You know, it's like... It's like Groundhog Day. Every day I'm doing the same thing, to the point where I just didn't want to write. I didn't have the creative spark. I just didn't, you know, COVID was just a bad time. And this is the first book I've ever written in my entire history. I was doing two books a year, one every 6 months, that I was late on my deadline because I just didn't have the creative energy.
Yeah, you weren't alone, Brad. I know others who had the same issue. It's very difficult if you need that spark of fresh air and whatever, different kind of environment. So what do you turn, under normal circumstances, what do you turn to or who do you turn to for inspiration?
Most of my inspiration actually comes from the news. I still do security consulting for asymmetric threats for various people, and I get a lot of feeds from all over the world on various news reports here, there, and other places. And most of the inspiration is I'll see a story and I'll be like, that's a story. Well, for instance, I mean, we're talking about COVID. I wrote The Widow's Stride years ago. I think it was book 4 or 5. And there was a story that H5N1, which is avian flu, which is much more deadly than COVID. It's like a 40% mortality rate if you get it. The good thing about it is it doesn't pass airborne. It doesn't pass human-to-human. Most people that get it are in the poultry industry or something. They cut their finger and they have a sick bird. Mm-hmm. But it's a 40% mortality rate. It's enormously deadly. And so somebody decided that, you know, we're going to make this thing airborne so that we can create a vaccine for it. We're going to make it deadly because we're afraid the mutation sooner or later is going to occur. And they posted that. They were going to post it on a scientific journal overseas in the EU, and our own biomedical research facility said, you can't post that. You're basically posting a bioweapon. You're telling somebody how to make a bioweapon. Wow. And at that time, nobody ever heard his name, least of all me.
Right.
The guy who signed that letter was Anthony Fauci. Back then, nobody ever heard of him. But I saw that story, and I was like, oh, wow.
Interesting.
Right there.
Interesting.
And I wrote The Widow's Stride.
Yeah, and it's interesting how an idea from a long time ago can come into play as well. It can become more timely sometimes. You know, it kind of festers there in the back of the brain and then suddenly becomes more timely.
Well, actually, I kind of pat myself on the back because what she does, she's an asymptomatic carrier of it, just like you hear nowadays. Back then, I did all the research on it, and she's an asymptomatic carrier, but she can infect everybody. And she's doing social distancing. She's wearing a mask. She's only drinking bottled water, all this kind of stuff. When I was reading the book after COVID, I was like, wow, we're all kind of living that now.
Yeah. Yes. Who thought? I was thinking the other day, and I was watching something on the news, and it was a country in Europe. I think it was Norway. But I was thinking how we've become so used to seeing people in masks. I mean, I remember going out in my mask for the first time, and I was like, oh, I feel like a right nerd. But obviously everybody else did too. And now it's just become so routine.
When I was deciding whether I'm going to include COVID in the book, well, I'll tell you that when I did research for The Widow's Stride, I went to Hong Kong and Thailand and Singapore and everywhere else. They all wear masks.
Yeah, yeah.
Get off the airport and they're taking your temperature. This is in 2014, I want to say. I mean, you hit the ground, they're taking temperature. You would see you'd go to a supermarket, and there would be a sign saying, these door handles are cleaned every 15 minutes. You would see signs at a park saying, if there's a dead bird here, don't touch it. They've been living with, so when you see guys wearing masks in Asia, they've been doing it forever. Here in the United States, we just started doing it, and for writing about COVID, that actually, I hate to say it, but it's kind of a benefit for a thriller writer, or actually for real-world operations. Mm-hmm. So if you're, say you're going to do an operation in London. London's got more cameras per square foot than any other place on Earth. I mean, we caught the Boston bombers here in the United States. How'd we do that? We did it through surveillance footage. We put their pictures up and said, this is the guys we're looking for. And then someone came forward and said, I think I know who that is. Well, nowadays, you wear a mask, sunglasses, and a hat. You look like a bank robber, but so does everybody else.
Right, right.
Hate all of those, the ability of anybody doing surveillance on you.
Yeah. Yeah, it always hits me when I go home. And one of the things I do, apparently, all the time, according to my brother, is speed in the car. Because the cars are different and the roads are smaller and, they're zigzaggy. And he's like, you have to slow down. There's cameras everywhere. There's cameras everywhere. And occasionally you'll see a flash and, know that they've got you. It's not a very comfortable feeling. Even though it's my country, I don't really like it very much.
Yeah, I tell you, when I was for No Fortunate Son, we went to Ireland and all over London and Cambridge and everywhere else, and I made my wife drive. Driving on the road, there's several times where we were entering a traffic circle and exiting, into oncoming traffic because we had to drive.
Yeah. Well, even I get confused at those big roundabouts now. They've got like six lanes going around a roundabout, and I'm like, okay.
Right.
My mantra is push the passenger up the curb. The passenger has to be next to the curb, the curbside, because I forget. You just drive automatically. So I know you consider yourself a writer at heart. I think we've talked about this before, how you keep a notebook on a book. But I was listening to you talk, and you said that you'd included a character in your first book and indicated that he was married in one line. And then years later, somebody says to you, what happened to his wife? And you're like, he's not married. So how detailed are those books that you keep?
I just started doing it, to be honest with you, because of that. I don't have a Bible of characters. I have a journal that I just keep when I'm writing the current book. And I'm convinced in my own head that I know everything there is to know about every character there is. And I constantly make mistakes. So like Amina in Daughter of War. So she's a Syrian refugee, and I was going to kill her in chapter 4 and just be done with it. But I liked her too much, so I kept her all the way through, and she took over the book, which the book's title was Shadow Strike, which then changed to Daughter of War because she just kind of took over the whole book. And now she exists in the Pike Logan universe. So I'm writing a short story with her, Exit Fee, and I changed her eye color. I thought for sure I knew what her eye color was, and somebody said, she had this color eyes in the first book, and now she's got this color eyes. And then I'm like, damn it! You keep making these mistakes.
Well, it's 16 books in. Come on, and other stuff that you're working on. You've got some excuse there with all these characters that you're dealing with, whether it's.
I'll say that the readers will catch it. Every single time.
Absolutely. I catch things on TV all the time. I'm like, wait a minute. It's got a different outfit on and it's supposed to be in the same scene. different tie or something. But how did this book help you grow as a writer? Because we grow with each project.
I think that as a writer, just as a mechanic side of the house, I learned I can muddle. I've never had any trouble writing. Comes out of I have a great imagination. My wife calls me Walter Mitty. Hang that stuff out. And this one was the first book where I literally had to sit down and say, you have got to write something. Get it out, because of the way COVID was working. I lethargically laid around for, a month, and I was like, this thing is due. Get this thing out. And I had to force myself to write. And I learned I could do that. I mean, a lot of writers talk about, writer's block, and I've never had that, ever. And this time I learned that, you can write a good book. I mean, my wife says I have the 12 stages of Brad's writing process, which stage one is, we're doomed. I've got no story. And then stage, five is, I hate this book. then stage 12 is I'll always read the book before I go on a book tour, because I'm working on book 17 right now, and you kind of forget about what you've written. And I read it and I say, damn, this thing's a good book. Did I write that?
Well, job well done, Brad. Entertaining, as always, really well written, and it really, the story really draws you through. I know listeners can find out much more about you and your books at bradtaylorbooks.com. You're on tour right now, right?
Yeah, I just got home. Well, it's kind of a staggered tour because of the way COVID's working. Some places want to do it, some don't. So I'm home for a couple of days. I do a book launch. We call it the book launch. It's basically a giant book party. If you're in Charleston, South Carolina, come to the party.
Yeah.
On this Friday. And then I've got a virtual event tonight, and then I go back on the road to do some book festivals, Tucson, Naples, Florida, that kind of thing.
Great. Well, good luck on your tour, and stay safe, stay healthy, and a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
Yeah, I guess if you mentioned bradtaylorbooks.com, if they want to read an excerpt to get a flavor of this book, or actually any of the books, excerpts are on for any book I've written are up there if you want to get a flavor of it.
Awesome. Thank you. And the book again is called End of Days, and my guest, Brad Taylor. Brad, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.